Welcome to the Mo Show podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in across our audio platforms. Big episode today with Rio Ferdinand. We shot this in the beautiful city of Al Ula, Saudi Arabia, and I thoroughly enjoyed shooting this, getting to know Rio, hearing of his future plans. I really think you guys are going to enjoy this. Just before we kick off, a reminder to download the CAFT app. We have linked it in the show notes across YouTube and the audio platforms. It'll really elevate your experience once you're within CAFT. I've lived a life without it, then with it, and I've realized that it just made my life so much easier in navigating my way through CAFT with the app. So give that a shot when you get a chance. Yesterday, we had some big news coming out. We partnered up with our newest sponsor, Noon. Noon is a leading digital commerce platform in the Middle East. I'll tell you about their two latest services in Saudi Arabia, Noon Minutes and Supermall. Noon Minutes, as the name says, they deliver thousands of products in just 15 minutes, whether it's groceries, household appliances, or even electronics. No one does it faster. And then we have Supermall, the ultimate destination for fast premium shopping, whether it's the latest tech, skincare essentials, or everyday must-haves. Noon has you covered, so stay tuned for more and enjoy the episode.
Well, thanks, Rio. I know we've been wanting to do this for a while now. Better late than never. I think Riyadh, a year and some change ago, we had a conversation, and then for whatever reason, we couldn't shoot.
Schedules,
yes. But honestly, thank you so much for making time.
No problem.
I've only met you once or twice before, but I feel like I've known you a lot longer. You have that effect on people.
Thank you.
It's not your first time, huh? You've been here before.
No, I came here a couple of years ago. One of my first visits to Saudi, and I went to Riyadh and then connected to here, and it's just like it blew my mind. It was like the spiritual element that comes with coming here, the history, and this was one of my first experiences of Saudi. And this is like, if you get this as your first experience, crazy.
It is. It's a lot different to the cities.
Yeah,
you really do feel like you're. You do feel some sort of higher being. I've said this a lot. When I'm here, I do feel some elevated sensation.
Different energy comes here, like definitely spiritual, definitely relaxing. When my wife was saying to me, like, what's it like then? Explain to me. And I was like, if you can imagine what Mars might look like a little bit, but with great food and great people. This way, with all of the architecture that surrounds it, it's just crazy.
You know, for the longest time, I mean, all my growing up years, the 80s and 90s, we never knew of Al Ula. It was only until 2017, 2018, with Vision 2030, spearheaded by obviously MBS and Prince Badr, did we start to see and hear that there's something happening away, something happening 5-6 hours away from Jeddah by car in this place called Al Ula. And then we saw pictures, and then they built Mariah, and then a couple of 5-star hotels came up, this one being the last. And now people from all over the world, if you walk on the street, when we're done shooting, I'll take you behind the hotel, you'll see people from all over the world, China, Malaysia, Australia, a lot of backpackers. And I'd have conversations with them. I'm like, how do you guys hear about Al Ula? They're like, everyone's talking about it.
Yeah,
we're sick of the places we've been going to all our lives.
Yeah.
You know, we want to experience something new.
I think social media's played a big part in that, hasn't it, as well? Like amplifying the visuals. I think that's what's the biggest thing here. The visuals that you get here are like anywhere else. And so when that kind of transports then to different parts of the world, you're like, most people, you think about it, we go to the same places. We're creatures of habit. We just go where we're comfortable, where we know people, where we're the same restaurant for the last 15 years, same beach for the last 15 years. And there is sometimes, there's not that much that makes you go, whoa, I can change, I need to change that and go there. This is one of those places because it is, again, it doesn't have a beach, but it has so much more.
I've been wanting to ask you this question when I met you in Riyadh the once or twice, but I said, let me not ask it to you until I eventually can have some cameras on us and some mics under our chins. Jamie Carragher said a few things that weren't nice about us or our league a year or so ago. And you stood up for us. You said, actually, hold on a minute. No, I'll not allow you to say that. Words to that effect. What made you want to defend us?
I think, firstly, it wasn't just Jamie Carragher. Because I think if it was just Jamie Carragher, then I don't know, would I ever spoke? Because it's one voice isn't enough to kind of antagonize you sometimes. But there was many voices in the media. There was many entities in media that made it seem like the big tournaments shouldn't be held in this region. And I was like, And they will go, oh, because of these reasons, because they're the negativity that surrounds X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, wow, that's like, like people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. Where I'm from isn't a perfect country. The States isn't a perfect country. We all have our problems and our issues. But it's about, there's a thing now we call cancel culture. Are we going to cancel? I don't believe in cancel culture. If someone makes a mistake, if they're willing to talk about it and willing to embrace and look at ways in which to work around it, to move forward, and the critical thing is at their own pace, which should be respected, then I think people need to respect that and go, you know what, actually, we'll come on that journey with you and we'll try and help you educate you. We'll try help bring new things to your region and to your mindset. But there's also so much that we could learn from your culture and whatnot that goes on here. And for us to be sitting there, definitely from our media perspective, to be sitting there and pointing fingers and saying how bad and how negative it is for anybody from this region to be from Qatar, from Saudi, to host a World Cup, and listen, it didn't matter if it was Saudi or Qatar, whoever it was, I don't agree with that. I just really don't think it's the right thing to do because, again, I stressed the point at the time, we aren't perfect and there's certain issues that were being flagged, that it's taken our countries years and years and years and years and years to get used to, then actually change to, and then mold it into our society. And it's still not perfect where we are. And we're asking now countries that are younger than ours in many respects in terms of being open to actually change overnight and to be adaptable overnight and make those changes that took us 50, 60, 70, 800 years. We're asking others to do it in 2 years, 3 years. Mm. It's impossible. It's not right.
It was illegal to be gay in the UK in the 60s.
Yeah, exactly.
The UK is okay with it now. And I had a conversation with Henry Winter.
But the UK is okay with it in places. There's still people that aren't happy with it.
Yeah.
There's still people in media that aren't happy with it. There's still people anywhere in our country. It's not 100% everybody's fine with it. So it's still something that's being worked on in our country. But we're saying that here you should be absolutely ahead of it. Mm. It's crazy.
Because you're okay with it. You want us to be okay with it.
Yeah.
Everyone is on their own timeline. It's something I told Henry Winter. We went back and forth on it. Yeah.
He's a good guy as well, Henry.
He's a?
Good guy.
Good guy. Yeah, I agree. What shocked me was the great BBC choosing not to air the opening of the World Cup in Qatar. It should be bipartisan. It should be bigger picture. People in the UK and wherever they watch BBC would like to see the opening, but you didn't because you were never for the World Cup in Qatar. Mm. Not to mention the countless articles that have been published leading up to the Qatar, hoping that they can stall it so it can be hosted somewhere else. Mm. You love the game and you want to see it grow all over the world. But unfortunately, that's not something that the rest of the football world wants to see.
I always look at this. This is what baffles me. What makes our game so great and better than every other game in the world, any other sport is the best, is that it's actually a worldwide sport.
Yeah.
Like we hear American sports like the NBA and NFL say it's world champions. It's not world. They're not world champions. It's played predominantly in that country. It's
US champions.
Not many. It's the US champions, basically. This is the world. When you go to a World Cup or you go to a Euros or whatever, it's them areas exactly spread out of one country. It's not just one country. And I think that to then say, oh, we're going to pick and choose who should have it, that's not how football was born. Football was born for everybody to play. You don't need loads of equipment. You need a ball. That's it. And everyone's having fun. It's one universal language. Do you know what I mean? So like to then go, oh, we're going to pick and choose and say, actually you, because we're sitting on a pedestal here and put ourselves up there and we're looking down on you and you're not going to have it because of these reasons, societal reasons, is I don't think the right way. And football wasn't born out of that. Football's an inclusive game where you want everybody to participate, men, women, any different ages from any different culture and background. And that has to be embraced. And that has to come from the top. FIFA, UEFA, all the federations have to promote that. And I think they are, to a certain extent. But again, is say their messaging is, yeah, we want everyone in the world to play football. The media aren't on the same page. The media have their own political stance and their own axes to grind, where they're singing from a different hymn sheet And there's different reasons as to why they're doing that. And that's where it becomes a bit of a problem in the middle. Mm-hmm. And that's why there has to be voices like yours, like mine maybe, and other people who have become almost like media entities in their own right. The players nowadays have such a huge voice. They're bigger than a lot of these media companies we're talking about. They have bigger platforms, more followers. So they've got big ears to kind of shout into. And that's why whenever I speak to players and I interview players for my podcast and when I'm around traveling, watching games, I'd always try and stress to the players, you've got a big, strong voice, man. You've got a great position now to really use it for good when it suits you, when you're ready, when you're confident enough to do that. And fortunately enough, people like yourself, myself, we're in positions where we can talk. But I'm not going to pick and choose what I talk about because something suits me. If something comes up in the media and I don't agree with it, I will say it 100%.
And that's what's refreshing about you, Rio, because you went against the grain. You said what many people were thinking but didn't want to say it. And all of a sudden I saw Piers Morgan follow suit.
Mm.
And he really backed, you know, the Qatar World Cup. But I didn't see that before you were outspoken about it.
Yeah.
So I think you made it okay for the next person to say, hold on a minute, they deserve a chance to grow their league too. Why can't they?
Yeah, definitely. And I think Piers is obviously an advocate now. He's been coming over here now. But I think because you see, here there's like there's a refreshing hunger to improve, to show and tell, to no one's protecting anything here. That's what I like. Where I'm from, and football in general, in a lot of the big countries where I'm from, who've kind of a part of the top tier, the top table, it's almost like everyone's guarding the game. It's theirs. They're custodial kind of people over the game, and that's not football. You're meant to open that table up and bring more people to the table. There's enough on that table for people to share and to be a part of. And why that Saudi wants to become one of the top five leagues or top five or six leagues in the next 10 years, why is that a red flag? How? Why is that? When the States were trying to do that and have been trying to do that for many years, everybody was going, yes, brilliant. Oh, well done. David Beckham's gone over there. Back to Pele when he was going over there back in the day. Gerrard, Rooney, everyone was cheering them going there. But then because Saudi have then said, we're going to try and do that, we're going to do it in our own way, that's wrong. That's what really irked me at the beginning. It can't be right for you and wrong here. What's the reason?
Yeah. It's discrimination.
Exactly.
Speaking of Saudi wanting to build a top five league in the world, and I know that's the aspiration of Prince Abdulaziz and everyone at the Ministry of Sports, how could we best go about achieving becoming a top five league in the world? What's something that, you know, coming from a player who's done 20 plus years in the league, that you can maybe throw in there as a bit of an advice? You know, guys, if you really want to do this, have a look at this. How do we get top five status?
I don't think it's an overnight thing. It's a very difficult, I think, task ahead, but I do think it's achievable. But I think you've got to come at it at multiple ways. And I don't think there's one solution. You 100% have to get the infrastructure right at the top. And it's a top-down kind of look at this. But also you need the underbelly then to be pushing. And I think that the foundations of having the pyramid of football looking in the right way from top down and upwards as well, from bottom up, where you've got the young people in this country have the infrastructure around them to participate on a regular basis. I only became a footballer because I was out every day playing football and it wasn't structured. I had a pitch, just a pitch. It was hard floor like this. Didn't need huge facilities. But if you can put some pieces in place like that where they have the ability to look out their window and they can see there's areas to play football, the more of those there are, the more exposure they're getting as well from the media, with the likes of Cristiano and the big names that come in, make kids want to get out and go and play. But if there's no areas to play, then you're not going to have the bottom-up kind of push that I was saying that you need to create the amount of players that you need to have a pool of players that you can pick from to then create elite players. But all of that infrastructure of training facilities, uplifting the coaching, creating more coaches, and then centres of excellence. You look at Clairefontaine in France, created all them great players when they won the Euros, like Thierry Henry and Elka, etc. Clairefontaine's a place where that was a centre of excellence. We have St. George's Park now, So these a place like that for the elite to go to, once you've built the foundations at grassroots level, I think you have an opportunity. Listen, I understand, and I the strategy of bringing a Cristiano, undoubtedly the right thing to do, and players of that ilk, the Benzemas, etc., Ballon d'Or winners at the time, that's great. And I think that was a time and that served its purpose. But I think there has to be a push, and I'm seeing a little bit of that now, where you're going to go for the 24, 25-year-old, the 18, 19-year-old, and go, like, we want to create an underbelly of talent that isn't on the latter stages of their career, on the other side of the mountain going down. We want the ones that are still coming that way now, which will, I think will solidify the league and definitely raise the standards. But I do, it's a long answer, but yeah. I do also believe that within that, you absolutely have to promote local talent. There needs to be a mechanism that obviously there's a number of players for and that you can have, but that has to be stringent. That has to be absolutely managed, where the governing bodies are in the clubs. Where is the local kids? Where's the local players coming? And that's my point about the grassroots, pushing that door open consistently.
Like the academies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that's something that's really, really on the priority list of the Ministry of Sports, to get kids access to football, you know, the facilities, the fields, you know, to get boots on their feet and to get playing at a young age.
When I watched the game, Diego Maradona, I watched when I was a kid at the World Cup. What did I do after that game? I went straight outside with a ball.
You played.
And I'm playing.
Yeah.
Now they have so much more opportunity to watch players. That watching a game, being inspired and going outside is happening 2-3 times a week now.
Yeah.
But if you haven't got that space to go outside, where is it? Where are we going to find that next player?
It's not going to translate. Yeah. Yeah. The league's made a lot of noise all around the world. Is it still, like, in your line of work, are people still talking about, you know, the Saudis are... you know, they have our attention now. Do you still hear the name Saudi League in your line of work?
Yeah, you do. I think there's ups and downs. The attention goes crazy for a while and then it goes down. But it's there. I think there's an undertone that is still there. But I think it's like any league. That happens with La Liga, where I am.
Yeah.
That happens with the Bundesliga. Harry Kane doesn't score for a few weeks. It goes quiet. All of a sudden scores, everyone hears about it. Same would be with Ronaldo and the league that you have there. But I think every couple of years, a shift in approach definitely, I think, reverberates around the world of football, because everybody's eyes are here subliminally. They're just, something's happened over there. They've moved a needle. What are they doing then? I think consciously doing that is, I think, a definite healthy thing for this region to do that, to make sure the interest stays here, because you want interest to be here, because the World Cup is coming here. That's not a if, but, or maybe anymore. That's a fact. So generating that interest consistently over the next years leading up, I think, is critical to creating the foundations for a very, very successful World Cup.
So if you have a conversation with a talented player who's in his prime, as you most likely have, and they're thinking of a move to Saudi Arabia, what do you say to them?
I think it's difficult. There's not one answer to that again. I think it's why are you going to go there? What's your motivation? Is it lifestyle change for you? Culturally, does it suit you? Financially, is it much more beneficial for you? And are you going to, do you feel you'll be happy stepping away from a European league, which is a more mature league? And if them questions are getting ticks, or more of them questions are getting ticks than crosses, go. 100%. I've got two kids now. I've got 18-year-old and 16-year-old. Both play at Brighton. Both aspiring to be footballers in the Premier League. And if a Saudi team came for them, there's no way I'm saying, right, that just goes off the table immediately. Let's go. I want to open up that offer and have a look. And there's a conversation being had in my house. 100%. I think that's the way that things are now. Saudi is here. It's a league that are trying to really push themselves and be one of the main leagues. So they're going to make waves and they're going to have to do some big things. And I think a lot of families, a lot of players, a lot of wives are going to be having these conversations over the coming years now.
What about the game? We've seen basketball, a sport I follow closely. The difference between the three-pointer and Steph Curry has changed the game completely. There's more three-pointers to the tune of, I think, 4 or 5% growth year on year in the last 10 years than ever before. It's almost, some say it's ruining the game. There's just way too many threes. Do you see any changes happening in the game of football? How do you see it evolving in the next 10 years? I asked this question to a footballer a couple months ago, and he said keepers need to know how to play sweeper. Keeper need to push up and like that Manuel Neuer.
Neuer.
You know, more of that going forward. Yep. Do you see a way that, you know, if we watch this episode in 10 years' time, what would you say now so that your 10-year self from now would say, ah, I was right about that assumption that I made or prediction?
I think right now we're in a time in the last 5 years, 6 years, we've been, the game's become a very systematic game where the system overrides individuals. So the maverick player, the number 10 player has been kind of driven out of the game a little bit for the last, other than Messi, for the last 6, 7, 8 years. You see that it's all about, you have to be in that position because it balances the team. You have to be there and play this way, you're almost robotic, which I think dampens the enjoyment factor of football. Because I got involved in football for people like Diego Maradona, who excite me, who do things that are not meant to be happening in the game, that are off the cuff, that aren't part of the tactic rule book. And I think we're going to come back round to that. And I can see glimpses of that now coming back. Cole Palmer at Chelsea, those type of players now that I think are going to be able to express themselves even more. I think Jack Grealish will look back in 5, 6 years, 7 years, 10 years maybe once he's retired and go, I wish I was in this era now where the players are allowed to be more free, because that's what he was when he went to Manchester City. Now he's a systematic player more. And I just think that then I think the interest of the game goes up again, and the love of the game, and that fairy tale, that unexpected moments, you get more of them, which then glues people back to the TVs a bit more, I think.
I miss your era. It was more exciting.
Yeah, it was okay to be naughty and bad and to be rough and there were subplots. Say it was Manchester United versus Liverpool or Arsenal, whoever it was. That was the story, but then there was two or three stories underneath still going on. You don't get that now. You know what I mean? Everyone's friends. Everyone's social media buddies, which is cool. It's fine. It's a different era, but it just takes away that. Like, I want to see a fight. I want to see an argument. I want to see bad blood. Vieira and Keane, the Arsenal-Man United game.
Tunnel.
Yeah, like that's like 20-odd years old now, but we're still talking about it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So what, we need that more.
I think it got more eyeballs on the game as well.
Yeah, it did, yeah. You know. It becomes a soap opera.
It does.
Doesn't it? Yeah. But we want that, no? We all watch crazy TV. So we watch like garbage TV a lot of the time, and it revolves around arguments and bad blood.
But, I mean, Suarez and Diego Costa, I think, were the end of it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they were, yeah.
Antagonizers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Antagonism may be frowned upon now rather than embraced.
Yeah.
Like they were enjoyed. Like they caused trouble. They're enjoyed before. I want that, man.
It's not just football, by the way, Rio. It's basketball as well.
Yeah.
Handshakes at the end of games was never a thing in the NBA, and now it's you know, they're borderline swapping jerseys and
it's too nice, isn't it?
And making dinner plans on the court. You know, we just lost by 30 points. Why are you talking to the star on the other team?
I don't want to see smiles. Don't want to see jokes when you just got beat.
But your era, that would never be. You would never allow that though at the end.
Gerard Piqué. I always tell this story. He was friends. He grew up with Cesc Fabregas.
Okay.
And obviously Cesc was at Arsenal. Gerard was in Man United. In the tunnel before the game, Gerard and Cesc Fabregas were having a big hug, embracing. How you doing? Long time no see.
God.
Played the game, come in after, and about three or four of us hammered Gerard Piqué. What are you doing? Oh, mate, Pally, all friends, are we? We're all friends. Taking the mick out of him, really, just to say, listen, that doesn't happen. But it's just different generations. Are we just being old school, or is it just we've got to adapt to the new generation? Do you know what I mean? Should we just evolve, though? Are we just stuck in our ways?
I think just the new school is softer.
Mm.
You take the neutral. If you ask a 70-year-old today, he'd say, no, I'd much rather watch football when I was 50 than I do at 70. So he's impartial to both generations. If you ask a 70-year-old that, I'm telling you, he would much rather watch Manchester United, irrespective of their performance, from 2010, 2010, then 2015 to 2025.
Yeah, no, I get that 100%. I agree, but in terms of your point about it being, it was tougher back then. Yeah, I think people were tougher, but I think these guys have to deal with a bit more, like social media. Like if I finished a game, I had one show on TV matching a day and the Sunday newspapers.
That's it.
When those papers are put in the bin that day, we're talking about something totally different. That's gone. Whereas now on social media, it's forever there. And all the guys have these on their phones on and they're seeing everything and it's constantly there. So mentally, I think these guys have to do with a lot more than we did.
That's true.
But there was other tests for us.
Yeah.
That were different.
It's a lot more microscopes on you these days.
Yeah. You can't move, man. No,
you can't sneeze. What do you miss most about your playing days outside of maybe the physicality and all that? But what do you sometimes reminisce? My guess would be the Manchester Derby. Is there anything else?
Mm-mm. Going to Anfield and beating Liverpool at Anfield. That feeling, bro. If I could put that in a cup and sell that in the shops.
Euphoric?
Oh, I'd be a billionaire. Because that feeling, when you're hated and you walk into a cauldron like Anfield and you get the job done and the whistle goes, you celebrate and you walk off the pitch slow and you look into the eyes of some of them fans and you look deep in their soul and you can see the pain. It's a beautiful feeling, man. That feeling, woof, I'll never get that feeling back again.
You think about it a lot.
As a player. But when I go to them games or when I go to the big games, like the Champions League semi-finals, knockout stages and finals, that's when the smells start coming back and the feelings start coming back. But in the main, I don't miss playing in the main. Just those really specific moments I do miss when I start thinking about them. But yeah, I'm satisfied. I'm kind of content.
Was winning everything for you?
Yeah. Winning became almost to a point where it was probably affected my personal life, affected relationships with family members and friends. Where I had to sacrifice. And I think everybody does this in any walk of life, in any businessmen and women, other sportsmen. When you want to be elite, you have to make like cold sacrifices. Like there's so many different things that happen in my family, events, big monumental things that go on that like I'm just shut off from. Like, and even when I'm there, I'm not really there. I'm not in the moment with those people or those moments that because I was so kind of obsessed with winning it. Whether it be a training game to a game on the weekend for Man United, it was just like, it became such a, it altered the mood, every result, massively. But I wouldn't change it. And I don't think I could have ever been as successful as I was or us as a team if we didn't have that running through our veins. If you could accept defeat and go, yeah, it's cool, man. On to the next one. We ain't winning next week. And we certainly aren't winning the league. We might win a couple of games, but we're not going to win week after week after week, year after year. Because you can't accept stuff like that. You can't accept poor standards, like a lack of consistency. And you can't accept, like, it's okay. We'll do it next week. That attitude was, that would just grate on me massively. It does now anyway, even in my life after football.
Mm. Was it an adjustment for you in the first couple of months of retirement where you're not driving to practice, you're not driving to games? Was that a bit of an adjustment for you?
You probably know my wife at the time, she passed away. So in a crazy way, I was kept busy with my kids in that period, in that time, which is very, very delicate for people that retire out of the game. It's normally a moment where there's like a crossroad and it's like, you either pick the wrong way or the other way or a good way. And a lot of players go the wrong way at that point in those months after retirement. I didn't have a time to sit and think. I was thrusted into being a single dad and just really focusing on looking after my kids and maintaining a new job, which was media. And so I never had time to think. I've not ever sat and worried about, oh no, I missed a game or anything.
Was her passing and your retirement, was that in the same year?
Yeah. I retired on the back of that. Oh, I was going to probably have another year maybe. Or I didn't even finish that season. It happened in just before the end of the season, I think about 6 or 7 weeks before the end of the season. And then I never went back to training.
Hardest year of your life?
Yeah. Well, it was the hardest couple of years because my mum had then passed away at the 18 months or 2 years later from the same thing, cancer. So, yeah, it was a... we're never prepared for death, you know? You know, like we even now I'm reading my kids' books. There isn't death in them books. So we're not preparing the kids. I was never prepared because everything's a fairy tale when you're growing up. Do you know what I mean? The person, the hero in the book always wins. So, and that's the one certainty we have in life, that we're all going to die at some point, but we don't talk about it, so you're never prepared. So when it happened, it was like my world just like shook completely, and I had three babies who I just needed to kind of just pick up and just like hold and not let go and then navigate your way through that. And obviously my mum at that time was a big part of that helping, but then she passed away. So it kind of compounded that moment. But I had good support around me, to be honest with you, my dad and my family, some friends. And I needed that massively.
I can't imagine what you had to go through. But clearly it made you... stronger person today. Yeah,
definitely.
Right? Yeah. Back to football. Any standout memories? You played with some, besides the legend that you are, but you played with some legends, Bex, Scholes, Giggsy, and Rooney. Any standout memories from the years that you played with them?
I think all of them had something. Like, Scholes was the most natural player I played with.
Amazing.
Like, you have to remember, this guy retired for 6 months, came back. I walked onto the bus. He was on the bus. He trained for a couple of days with us, but we just thought he was messing around. And then he was on the bus on the weekend, and I said, Scholesy, what's going on? What are you doing here? He said, no, nothing. Didn't even tell me. Went in, went, sat down in the change room, Man City it was, away, and the manager named the squad, and Scholesy was on the bench. Scholesy had been the best player in training for those couple of days he'd been training with us. He hadn't trained for 6 months. No other player could do that I played with. So naturally gifted. And if I wanted to turn a light on from the switch 30 yards away, and you had to hit the light with the ball from 30 yards, I'm picking Scholesy first. Like, ridiculous talent. But then Bex was like, David Beckham was like the best crosser I've ever seen cross a ball ever. I actually think he's the best ever there's ever been. How difficult it is to run with the ball at full speed and look inside and then cross a ball and it go on the perfect area where the striker needs it so consistently. I've never seen anything like him. And free kicks in training. We used to sit there, England team, and just watch him. Just taking free kicks in practice.
We only see what's on TV. You've seen a lot more.
Yeah, no, crazy, crazy. Wayne was just like a ball of aggression, man, but with crazy talent. Like, he was, especially when he was young, when he first came to United, he was just like, the switch could just go at any point with him. But he had so much quality and his intelligence as a player. Because he was so, his shirt was always ripped and he had bald head and he looked like an aggressive little pit bull.
Yeah, pit bull.
Right? People sometimes forgot that he had super intelligence. Like, his game intelligence was like so high.
Really?
His game IQ was like ridiculous. And he would win games for us sometimes on his own. And I used to see players looking at him in the tunnel going like, is that Wayne Rooney? I could see it. Never said it, but I could see them in their mind just going over, is that really Wayne Rooney? He was great. Obviously, Cristiano was Cristiano. He was just from another planet. Like, never seen anything like it. Don't think we ever will. But it's funny with Cristiano. He's kind of had, I don't know if there's any player that I know that's ever had two world-class careers in one. So when he was at United, he was an entertainer. And he was, and then he became like a goal scorer, but entertained as well at Man United. He was world class there, Ballon d'Or winner. Then he and a winger, left winger. Then went to Real Madrid, became a number nine, and became and was world class and was winning matches all on his own. That's two careers in one.
Yeah,
and both of them have been world class and won Ballon d'Ors in different ways. That's like asking Lamine Yamal to play right wing where he plays now and be a Ballon d'Or winner and then go to centre forward as a number nine like Haaland and win it. It's not happening.
You don't see that.
Not happening. Yep. Vinicius isn't doing it. He's not going to be a left winger and then be a number nine. It's not going to happen. Mbappe hasn't done it. When you think about it like that,
it's
crazy.
It's crazy. And he did it for a decade at United and a decade at Real Madrid.
Just the longevity is another thing. Him and Messi need to take crazy credit, the longevity. And they've had a lot of luck as well in terms of being injury-free as well. But that's testament to them and the way they keep themselves in shape.
Truly. In the way that he approached the game, even in United days, did he approach it in a very meticulous way where he always took care of his body as he does at Al Nassr?
Yeah, he was way ahead of everybody. He cared about the science. Hmm. I only started going in the gym when it got to about April, when I knew the beach was going to be coming in another couple of months. I had to get in shape. Everyone knew when I was in the gym. It was that time of year. Yeah, the beach is coming. We all need to get in shape. I've done a bit through the year, but it wasn't meticulous. I relied very much natural aesthetics that I had. You see my dad now, mid-60s. He looks unbelievable. Like, I was naturally gifted physically. Cristiano, obviously, naturally gifted physically. But he cared about the science. He cared about the 1%. And that was before anybody else was doing it. He invested a lot of money in recruiting people around him to be the best that he could be. So none of what he has achieved is by luck. He's definitely created the mechanisms for him to maintain what he's done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, truly. He's in better shape than some of the 20-year-olds today.
Yeah, it's crazy. And he tells them.
He does. We discussed your favorite moment in playing for United, some memories of four or five players that I mentioned. But what about your favorite moment in your career? Was there a moment that stands out for you? A cup or a goal or a slide tackle?
I think there's a couple. I think when you get called up for your national team for England, that's like that's a culmination of all the hard work that's gone on. All of the cold nights, the late nights, the travel, your parents making sure you get to train and get home, the diligent work that goes on when no one's looking, when there's no spotlight, there's nothing on you, just you and the ball, you and the grass. That's when you go, whoa, like what an achievement this is. And then I'm one of the best 11 players in this country out of millions. Like, when you start breaking it down like that and you go, whoa, this is like what I've achieved here. But the great thing is you never ever sit and dwell on that. You have a moment and then you move on. You don't enjoy it. Now is probably more when you enjoy those things and people talk about it and you get to kind of laugh and talk about that. But playing for England, definitely I had my nearest and dearest people in the stadium as well. It's an emotional thing for a family when that happens. And then winning the Champions League. Captaining a team to win the Champions League is like, that's Mount Everest, that's the Rushmore they call it, isn't it?
Yeah, Mount Rushmore. You know what, Rio, people probably represent, I don't know what your average duration of somebody representing their country, but I would imagine it's 3 or 4 years, the average. Mm. You represented England for 14 years. Mm. That has to be in the upper echelon of duration and representation. Do you ever look back and say, you know, I'm proud of all the work I put in, you know, 20 years playing professionally plus 14 years for England. Do you ever tap yourself on the back and say, I had a good career?
More now, like, because my kids ask me questions and then you talk and then it's like, actually, shit, man, dad was good. Like, and it's, you look at what players are doing now and then you compare what you've done and you go, actually, I'm looking at these guys like, wow, look what they're achieving. And some of them haven't even done what I've achieved. And then it makes you sit back and go, actually, I've done all right, man. But it's only really now, the last couple of years, I've done that because I don't know, before I just didn't. And definitely not in my career when I played. It's like you're hugely successful. You're doing great things, groundbreaking stuff, leading in your profession, I bet you don't sit there and go, wow, man, I am the guy. You don't, isn't it? Because the moment you do that, someone's coming up, taking over because you're sitting down just relaxing. So the amount of hard work that you go through, you said, very so similar. So many transferable kind of ways in which we deal with stuff from sport and other different industries.
Absolutely. Maybe when I retire, I'll look back and say,
yeah, man.
Any weaknesses of your game that you always wanted to work on? Or let's say, what was your biggest weakness in your game? My show manager said, don't ask him this question.
No.
I said, no, I'm going to ask him this question.
No, because we all have weaknesses. The thing difference is when you're playing, you'll never tell anyone. But my weakness definitely would have been being better at set pieces, attacking 100%. I didn't score enough goals. Didn't score many goals. You look at Ramos, scored loads of goals. Do you know what I mean? Vidic scored a lot of goals. Terry scored a lot of goals. Like, I wish I'd have been. I didn't care about going up for a corner. I was more like, if I got a clean sheet, that was me. I was happy. I was more invested in that than I was on set pieces. So I never even considered it, really. Never thought about it. Never broke down a set piece ever from attacking purpose. That definitely.
That comes with disadvantages. When you're going up against a striker on a weekend, he's like, you know, now I have to go against Rio.
Mm.
So because you are known as that centerpiece in the defense, that you're going to be in the head of the attack. Mm. So that comes with disadvantages.
Yeah, no, I get that 100%. But listen, there's so much in the game, like, that you feel, you look back and go, I wish I could have done a little bit better at that, or certain situations. I was lucky. I thought my game was quite rounded. But then it's more where I could have improved in moments. I remember moments in games when a ball's getting crossed. I should have been in a better position there. And I can remember that the FA Cup final, Drogba scored, that my body position was probably wrong. I could go through loads of games like that. I can go through training games if you want, like, they're like that, because they're just so vivid. More of them moments are in my mind than the actual successful ones,
yeah,
which is weird.
Were you hard on yourself during your playing days?
Yeah. As I got older, it got less and less, because you learn how to work things out and learn how to not overreact to situations, good or bad, and become more balanced. But definitely when I was younger, a bad game would there'll be hangover Monday, Tuesday, then we got a game maybe Wednesday, and then I'm going into a game still thinking about that bad performance or that moment in that game that I should have done better. So, and as I got older, I kind of, bad emotions would last a night, 24 hours, then on to the next game. And the better I was at that, the better performance was in the next game. Because you can't... Pep Guardiola said this to me. I interviewed him a while ago, and he said to me, the best players, like a Messi, when they make a mistake, the quicker that mistake is forgotten, the better that player, the next action is going to be.
Goldfish, you know, memory.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's very true.
2 days ago, Etihad played Shabab in the King's Cup semis. Etihad won 3-2. It was 2-1 to Shabab. Etihad scored in the 92nd and the 96th. And I reposted it. That's some Sir Alex Ferguson shit. my Shabab friends were not happy. looking back at your days with Sir Alex, what was it like playing for him?
Yeah, it was. I feel like our generation was lucky to play for a manager like that. I think that. How many times do you think he was on a training pitch, taking a session?
Every session.
You wouldn't feel one hand. He was there, but he didn't take the session. But his presence was more than enough. That's all you needed, just a presence. Because when he wasn't there, which was only a handful of times, the level. The training session intensity dropped a little bit.
Huh.
Like, just his presence there.
An aura.
And I think that he didn't have to say, during the week, he didn't say a lot. Game day, he'd speak about different things that are connected or disconnected to football at times to inspire you. He was great at that. But just his actions was a massive driver for me. And that's what I think I've tried to take on into my next phase of my life, where his dedication, his desire, his application, his determination, his punctuality, his standards every day, consistently, always high, always there, always turns up. And so when he hasn't got to say anything, because I just know that if I'm thinking or I have thoughts about maybe slacking or having a day off, he's been there 26, 27 years at that time, and he's still doing it. He's still first in, last out. How am I going to start just taking shortcuts now? Just should be illegal in your head. So,
did you up your level of excellence?
Yeah, because you want to get a well done from him. I mean, he wasn't good at giving us defenders well done enough. We used to, me and Vidic used to sit and say, man, he's always giving props to Rooney and Ronaldo, man. We're keeping clean sheets. Yeah, they scored the goals, but without us, they're nothing. But he kept us hungry. But he knew, he obviously knew that if he said, well done, too much to me, I might become the big guy and think I've made it and walk around a little bit more chilled, where he needed me to be on the edge still a little bit and still wanted to prove. So he was treating everyone differently. No, it wasn't a blanket approach, which was great as well. And again, that's transferable kind of skills that you can take into any walk of life.
Did you anticipate that he'd give you captaincy when he did?
I thought I should have had it earlier. I thought he was late. And then I lost it because I was injured. I kept getting injured. But you know what? I loved wearing the armband, but it wasn't the be-all and end-all for me. Like, I was a captain anyway. Like, I was normally the loudest.
Yeah.
Like, was it on the training ground or on the pitch? And I think your teammates, you know that you do your teammates what they think of you and how they see you. So that never really bothered me. But I mean, it's different. When it's moments, you get to a Champions League final and you've got the armband on. Like, that type of feeling there, again, that's another feeling. If you could bottle that feeling, you'd make a lot of money doing that as well, because it's just, you're leading a group of men up them steps to go and lift one of the biggest and hardest trophies to get your hands on, and the history that comes with that, and the hard work. That was like a culmination of like probably 4 or 5 years' work to get to that point, building that team. The a lot of sweat, a lot of blood and tears had gone into that. So, yeah, to lead that team was... And the group of players were there that time. You look at them, you've got the likes of Giggsy, Edwin, Scholesy. Then you've got like Vidic, Carrick, Tevez. Then you've got the young guns, Rooney, Ronaldo, Nani.
Yeah.
These guys, like, it's just crazy, man. Like, it was a crazy bunch of players. I've not even mentioned everyone, which is too many.
Brazilian there with braids?
Who?
I liked him, the Brazilian.
Anderson, yeah.
Anderson.
Yeah. Crazy. And like, a young kid, he was like 20 years old. He took a penalty. Like, it's crazy.
And Van der Sar in goal was a frigging wall.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. That's like some, I don't even think it was in your wildest dreams to one day lift the Champions League trophy as captain. I mean, that is something that probably everyone dreams of in their lives, and to do it and to say that you've done it, and I'm sure you have a picture of it somewhere up in your house, is like the ultimate, peak of the mountain, I would imagine for you.
Yeah, no, it is. And like you said, I didn't dream to lift the Champions League as a captain. That's how wild it is.
Yeah, it didn't even cross your mind.
You dream to win the Champions League,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, but not as
mean. So you dream to win these trophies, but getting there. And I'd got close before. You know, it's funny you say about the picture that I had in my house up. I didn't have any pictures of my house, you know, of football for years. Only really when I retired that I've got a couple of pictures here and there. And they're in areas you can't really, unless you go to that area, you can see it. But I had one picture up in my house, and it was when I was at Leeds and I was captain of the Leeds team, and we lost 3-0 in the semi-final of the Champions League. And it was a picture of me hunched over, and it had on the scoreboard Valencia 3-0 Leeds. And that's the only picture I had in my house of me playing football, weirdly.
And it was after a game that you lost.
Yeah.
And not the one that you won.
Yeah.
What's the reasoning behind that?
Just to remember where you are.
Wow. You've
still got a lot to do. You know what I mean?
Crazy.
Like, there's, as well as I was doing and playing, and I was going for the crazy transfer fees and winning games and started winning, that was like, but you haven't won that.
Shit.
Like, that's the bad boy. That's the big one.
As a reminder.
You haven't done that. And there's a reminder of what that felt like on that day. Because when I see that picture, the feelings of that come back immediately, how bad that feeling was. And so, yeah, I think sometimes we need inspiration. And when sometimes I'm visual. Like, I can't just think about it and go, sometimes I need a visual, like, little jab. And that was one.
There's a message that screams at me when I look at that picture.
Mm.
Work harder.
100%.
Become a therapy session. back to Sir Alex. With all due respect, but when he left the club, I feel like the magic did as well. I mean, you said that Nottingham Forest beat United 1-0. You didn't get any messages. It's almost been normalized.
How mad's that?
Crazy. They lost 3-0 for beginning of the season against a sub-team in the Premier League. 3-0 at home at Old Trafford. That never, ever, ever happens.
Mm.
And the magic left with Sir Alex, I feel. You know, Moyes tried to do his thing and then the other guy. And then, but it's not like your days. And it's a shame.
It's like I said to you before about the Saudi league.
Yeah.
That top-down approach, like, leadership is so huge. Who are the leaders that's leading the group? And it wasn't just Sir Alex, by the way. It was David Gill. Mr. David Gill was the CEO at the time. And they had a partnership. They were a team. And they both left together. And that was, I think, as big an impact as the manager almost. And then you get a new manager, which is always difficult. But you've also got new leadership above that. So that all wasn't going swimmingly well. And so I think it's no surprise that there's a downturn, but none of us could have said that there would be a downturn that would have lasted as long as it has now and gone as bad as it's gone now. And that's the wild thing when you're looking at Man United. And like you say, no one's even taking a mickey out of me anymore when we get beat because it's been normalised. Crazy. It hurts me.
It does.
It breaks my heart, man.
You've spoken a lot about mental health. What can the industry do to better support players in that area these days? We spoke about how social media can be brutal and maybe it's made the game softer today. It was a good point you raised. I never thought of that.
Mm.
But the whole mental health approach to the game, could more be done?
Yeah, I think so. It just needs to be a safe space for people. That's like a bit of a quote that everyone uses now. But as long as a player feels comfortable and safe to come out and say, listen, I'm not feeling good. Right now, this isn't me at the moment and I need help. The problem is that it's such a macho-driven sport, from the men's side especially. Like in our day, I was guilty of this. If anybody I felt wasn't playing to their maximum because they didn't feel right or I just saw a bit depressed or whatever, I would delete that guy and just go, you need to go over there. Go and see the doctor, whatever. Go over there. Don't come in this area because that's affecting us winning.
Yeah.
So, and that's not the right attitude. And I'm seeing a lot of the football clubs putting a lot of things in place. My kids are at an academy now in a Premier League team. And there's so many touch points with psychologists and whatnot to make sure that they don't get to that extreme point psychologically. So it's definitely moving in the right direction. But I just feel that it needs to be openly spoke about and not be judged.
What about you playing at Anfield? I'm sure you heard some horrific things from behind the goal.
Mm.
Did that ever affect you?
No, that inspired me, man.
It did, huh?
That made me just want to go harder. And it made the feeling of winning even better. The more aggressive and passionate the away fans were, it brings nerves, it brings angst. But I just used to think, if we get through this and win this, man, that feeling, I'm shutting all of them guys up. It's just an amazing feeling. But the problem you get, that's why the fans shout and scream a lot and make it hostile, because it can make some players wilt under that pressure and some players fold. And I've seen it with my own eyes. I've seen big players fold in those situations. And I didn't get it right every time. There were times when it didn't go right for me as well. And it might have got to me at times, but in the main, I can't stress out the feeling of coming out a rival's ground when you've won, man. Because I've got to go to the school run on Monday, drop my kids to school, and there's an opposing fan from that team at that school. I don't want that person coming up to me and saying, oh, what happened at the weekend? We beat you. And that fried my head. I couldn't deal with it. So little things like that even, man, just, it's a beautiful thing, man. That's what you miss. Do you know what I do miss? I miss that. When you've played a game, massive game, and you sit down after in the changing room, your shorts, your T-shirt, everything, socks, boots are on the floor in the middle. You're just sitting there and you're just sweating. Worked hard there, man. Got 3 points. That feeling is nice. It's a beautiful thing. Do you know what I mean?
There's no place. I've been to stadiums all over the world. I'll not take my 7-year-old to a game in England.
No?
And
why?
If it, definitely not behind the goal. It's brutal, the things that are said. Yeah. I took my son to Stamford Bridge. He was 4 years old. And we sat by the, was it the Hardy's end?
Matthew Harding.
Matthew Harding by the corner flag. I mean, I had to cover his ears every so often. Yeah, yeah. So I was like, I wonder what these players have to go through, you know, listening to such abuse. They're giving it to both sides.
Do you know what the thing is? I always think about that. It's not right in any other walk of life, but it's football, right? And as a young player, you grow up understanding that. But I always look at that, yeah, you're in a privileged position to be on the receiving end sometimes in that sense. When other fans, the veins are coming out of their neck, their blood coming out of their eyes almost, they want to get at you. That's like a privilege to be under that pressure. That's the way I thought about it. I'm so lucky to be here, man, that I can actually influence this result and his emotions. Mm. I can influence the way he's going to feel tonight when he goes home to his family on his knees. Imagine having that power part of that power. It's a beautiful thing, man.
Never thought of it.
Oh, I'm going to shut that guy up. I remember we played against Arsenal one time. I think it's Champions League, yeah? And this guy, he verbally assaulted Cristiano Ronaldo, the whole warm-up, and a few others. Got loud, every swear word you can imagine in the warm-up. Cristiano ignored him, yeah? And then I think Cristiano scored or whatever. I ran to that guy where he was in the stadium. He's near the front, and I was just going in his face like that. He couldn't fathom how I was even allowed to. He was going mad, trying to get stewards to get me. But I was like, this is what it's about.
Yeah.
This is the banter that I love.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You've done it first. It's all right. We didn't say nothing, but watch when we score.
Mm.
Beautiful.
Makes it all worth it.
Mm.
What's something that you'll never put up with, human behavior-wise? Types of people, characteristics. What's something you'll never stand for?
Discrimination.
As we said in the beginning.
Yeah, I don't stand for discrimination. I don't stand for that. That's well documented. I think when a lot of things come out and they're public, I do speak up. I use my platforms 100% to support people. Vinicius Jr. being one of the guys who's coming for a lot of racist treatment. But different forms of discrimination that I find way off the mark and out of order, I'll call it out. But at the same time, making sure that those that discriminate against people, I think, need to be educated and need to be helped. Again, I stress that. So it's a massive point of mine where it's not about saying, right, they're going to be cancelled. It's like, listen, are you willing to listen and to speak and to have a conversation and see where we can go? And the more you can do that, I think the better opportunities you've got to help and change people's views. Yeah. And the other one for me is just please and thank you. Like with my kids, I am so on that. Like, just please and thank yous go so far.
Courtesy. You don't see much of that these days.
No, man. Like, you sit in a restaurant sometimes, I see other kids in the restaurant, or even people, and they order something, and it's like, I'm waiting to hear the please and the thank you. And like, if my kids, sometimes they sometimes forget, they're caught up in what they're doing, and can I have this, please? Or just can I have this? And I'm like, what, please? Like, I'm quite kind of anal about stuff like that.
Yeah. I hear, bring me when I'm around Saudi. Bring me.
Yeah.
I'm like, if you're my kid, I'd backhand. Backhand. Yeah.
Backhand.
Bring me.
Federer.
Terrific. Yeah. Right down the line. Winner. Why defender? Did you ever play any other position?
I played midfield as a kid. I was always attacking as a kid. And I always wanted the glory. But then someone was injured when I was about 14 or 15. And the manager said, go and play at the back because I was quite tall. And I ended up playing there for like 5 or 6 weeks and I didn't like it. And every week I was going, listen, boss, when am I going to be going back into midfield? Because the player's back now.
Yeah.
Oh, no. And then about 6 weeks in, the guy said to me, listen, I've got to be honest. If you want to make it as a football player, I think you're better off playing at the back. And the day he said that, I just stayed there. Because all I wanted to do was become a professional footballer. So whatever I needed to do, I was doing it. There was no ego. There was no like, yeah, but I want to be the goal scorer and win games for the team. Do I look better there? Can I make it there? Yeah. Okay. Let's go.
Wow.
Mm. Crazy. Because some kids just say, no. I'm a forward. I'm not a midfielder. I'm going to stay there. But it's to the detriment of their game.
It's funny. Maybe you wouldn't have had the career you did at midfield.
It's crazy, right? My first 5 games for West Ham, I scored 2 goals.
Midfield?
So 2 goals in 5 games. I played midfield. So maybe I might have been a Bellingham before Bellingham. Who knows?
Why number 5?
I don't know. Do you know what? I was very superstitious as a kid. And I went to the World Cup. I was never superstitious about numbers before. I played number, I think my first number was 29 or 27. Don't know what my number was at West Ham. Then it was 18, I think, and then or 15. Then I went 29 at Leeds. I signed for West. Oh, then I went to the World Cup with England in Tokyo, and I was number 5, and I played really well. And then I was just obsessed with it. Then from then,
stuck with it.
Superstitious. I need that number. So when I signed for Man United that summer, Laurent Blanc, El Presidente, the main man, was playing at Man United, was number 5. And I signed my deal. And I remember looking at the number sheet of the players. And I went to the manager. I said to the gaffer, I said, listen, boss, just need to ask you a question. He said, what's wrong? I said, I need to wear number 5. I'm really superstitious. Can you get me a number 5 shirt, please? He went, I'll get back to you. Come back to me. And he said, Rio, you know Laurent Blanc, he's number 5. He's got one more year left. I'm not taking the number 5 shirt off Laurent Blanc. So I had to wear the first year, I wore number 6, which was okay. We won the league, which was great. But as soon as the number 5 became available, I was on it. And then it became my life.
Interesting. And you wore it ever since?
Yeah, I wore it everywhere I went after that.
I don't think many people knew that story. Wrapping up here. Anything comes close to the sensation of scoring a goal at Old Trafford? You have scored at Old Trafford.
Yeah.
Any sensations come close to that?
No, that euphoric immediate reaction to a goal, there's nothing that kind of, you can't replicate that. I don't know, maybe if you jump out of a plane, maybe, I don't know, I've not done that, but I don't know anything that's coming close to that. I don't know. Maybe if you're ringing the bell and you sell your company for a gazillion, maybe after having a really successful period, maybe that might come close. I don't know. But scoring a goal at Old Trafford.
I've heard the roar there.
Against Liverpool?
I went, I think it was 2 7 8 years ago. Liverpool at Old Trafford. I heard the roar. It's unbelievable.
Crazy.
It's not like the roar at Stamford Bridge, with all due respect.
No.
It's crazy there.
It's a thing of beauty, man. But yeah, I don't think there's anything else that comes close to that. Mm. I've got to be honest. There's different greatness in feelings and emotions. Like having kids is like, you can't replicate that. There's nothing that comes close to that. Getting married, there's like, but it's a different, it's not as like, bang, like out of like fireworks straight away in an immediate. And then it's just different.
Yeah. If you could have had today...
I hope my wife doesn't watch this. Jesus.
We'll keep it away from her. If you could have whispered something into Rio's ear when he was 18 years old today, the Rio today whispering something into Rio, the 18-year-old today, what would that whisper be?
It would be to separate yourself from your friends more at that age. In terms of socializing and enjoying the bright lights of London, I couldn't help. You have to remember. So I've gone from a kid from a council estate where I grew up, no real finances in our family to go and enjoy stuff like that. So I made it as a football player. Everyone's talking about me. I'll get invited to every single opening of a restaurant, a nightclub, bar, whatever in London. And I couldn't say no most of the time, unless it was a Friday. Day before a game, I was there. I'd go and I would get involved in everything. And if I could change that, I'd say to the 18-year-old me would definitely be, listen, just be a bit more strict and diligent. Now, listen, you fast forward to 25 years old, I became a different human being totally. Diligent, trained hard, worked hard, punctual, etc. But when I was 18, that wasn't me.
But you came around eventually.
Yeah, that's the good thing. I learned and I was good at learning. Even when I left London, that's why I left London. When I went to Leeds from West Ham, I could have gone Chelsea. They called me to go and I just said, listen, don't even talk to me about finances. And I have to get out of London because I knew that I was too involved in nightlife. So
London's a crazy town.
Yeah.
It'll suck you in.
Yeah. So many players have been sucked in and spat out. Definitely.
And then when Manchester United came calling, was it like the call you've been waiting for?
Yeah. Because we all want to be successful, don't we? We all want to win. Man United were winning. They had great players, great manager. And you want to go to be the best. and train against the best every day. Like, they look great from afar, but when you get in there, can I be one of them? Can I be as good as them? Can I be better than all of those guys? And they're the tests that I wanted. And then once I was at the World Cup, and I remember Nicky Butt and a few of the other Man United players were talking to me about, listen, the manager wants you to come to United. Like, and they were telling me how big and great Man United was. Listen, we go away of England and we got a lot of fans that follow us and there's a lot of cameras with us, but you come with Man United, whole different ball game, more of everything. And that just excited me, man. I just was like, I have to go. And then obviously they bid it for me, and the rest is history.
It really is like the glamour, you know, playing for Manchester United. You're in the spotlight. Everyone knows who you are when you play for Man United, at least back in your days.
Yeah, 100%. And you know what happened is, and how I know that even more now, and my kids and my wife. My wife didn't like football, never watched football. It's only her and her mum in her house when she was growing up, so she wasn't into football. But we go anywhere in the world now, on holiday or on business or whatever it is, and I'm with my missus or my kids. Even myself today, and they're the same, I'm quite amazed at like how many people still come up to us and speak, because it's all because of Man United.
Yeah.
It's all because of what I've done with Man United. And it shows you the power of the football club. But also if you align that to success, then it's like that is like a mixture that has just been like ridiculous in terms of for myself and the other guys and for my era.
True.
We're still very relevant now because of the success and the badge.
Yeah. Even just walking up to where we are here through the pool, you know, a few people were like, Rio.
Yeah, I ain't played football for like 12 years. It's crazy. But it's like, and I don't ever lose the sight of the fact that it is Man United. It ain't me. Like, I've played a part in it, don't get me wrong. But I know that there's been better players than me that have played for teams that aren't Man United that don't get recognised like it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I know.
Favourite player at each position? Favorite goalie, favorite defender, favorite midfielder.
Ever.
Yeah. Not starting 11, just favorite goalie.
Favorite goalie. I think it's Edwin van der Sar.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's done
a lot for
because,
you.
Yeah, he was just, we had a great relationship. We still do now. And I just think he made things look easy. Difficult things didn't look difficult with him.
Mm.
So Edwin van der Sar. Defender. I'd go Paolo Maldini. He was, again, another player who made it look very easy. He'd done things so efficiently. He was so quick. There's only one player I ever see consistently kind of do well against him, probably Ronaldo, the Brazilian Ronaldo. Mm. He was just a great footballer, done everything to a high level for many years.
Legend.
Midfielder? Nah. Midfielder. Ooh. Do you know what? It's weird. I'm going to have to name a few. Zidane was probably like one of the most poetic looking footballers you're ever going to see. Roy Keane was one of the most influential on a team that you're ever going to see. Riquelme. Do you know Riquelme, this guy? Argentinian guy.
Why am I not able to place him?
Oh, man. This guy is
what era?
You know who Riquelme is? How you know how good he was? He's Messi's favorite player. This guy, wow! Go on YouTube and check him out.
I will.
Another poetic footballer.
80s?
No, my era.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Went to Barcelona. Didn't do so well at Barcelona. Was at Villarreal. Was great there. Okay. Then Boca Juniors.
Killed me. Okay,
great player. And then Clarence Seedorf.
It's amazing. Dutch, yeah.
I reckon one of the most undervalued players who is in the elite top tier player with ridiculous footballer. Forwards is R9. R9 is my guy. Even my kid who's 4 years old knows R9. That's how much I love him. Like, he's just like, he was the best, man. I loved him. And you got Messi and Ronaldo.
Wow. Yeah, R9 used to do some magic when on the
ball. Have you watched anyone on YouTube lately?
Which one?
R9. If you type in
no.
R9 phenomenon, just put the video on, 8 or 9 minutes, change your life.
It's a magician.
See football. You look at football today and go, it's a disappointment.
Yeah.
What he was doing on the pitch. Oh, man. My kid now, my little boy said, Dad, can we watch the Brazilian Ronaldo, please? And I just put it on, man. 2 or 3 nights a week we're doing it. He was... When I watched him, when you watch him, man, football looks different.
Did a lot off the ball as well. I was gutted for him in the World Cup final, 98, how he had the flu that day. If he didn't,
they win.
France aren't winning 3-0.
They win.
Gutted.
Great player.
Yeah, he really was. Okay, we'll wrap up with this. How do you want to be remembered? When they say Rio Ferdinand, what do you want people to remember from that name?
I don't know if I want to be remembered as anything. Just a good guy. Someone who stood for something. But I think what's important to me now is that if in 10 years, 15 years, I'm walking down the street here and people come up to me and they're talking about Man United still, I'll be disappointed.
Mm.
There'll be a tinge of disappointment because that means that I haven't done something enormous or worthwhile or value to make someone go, no, that's Rio from this.
Yeah.
Oh, he played for Man United? I didn't know that. Or, yeah, I know that, but you know what he's done here or he's doing here? I want to do something meaningful in this next chapter of my life, and I'm working towards that. And I think, again, exploring new opportunities as well, I think, is important. I think, again, that's why I'm even here. Yeah. I'm coming to Alula here now, and I've invested in a couple of companies in Saudi, one of them being Curate, which is kind of putting on great experiences for people who want to come to different parts of Saudi Arabia, different events, making sure they see it through the lens that I saw when I came here. Mm. I think is so important because of that tinge of nepotism or negativity that comes from certain parts of media. This is another way in which you can kind of create a right narrative and the one that is actually true. Because after people that speak like this, and I'm digressing a little bit, but after people that talk in the media and you go to them, have you been to Saudi? No, but I heard and I read up and I, oh.
Yeah, shut up.
Okay, exactly. But how the f*** are you talking then? How are you talking like that with such conviction?
Fair enough.
And your words are carrying a lot of weight in those papers.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Journalistic integrity.
Yeah.
That's what's missing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what people like you bring.
I try. Thank you for standing up for us when you did with Jamie Carragher and many others. Thank you for continuing to visit Saudi. And not only that, I mean, you put your money where your mouth is, literally. You know, you're starting companies in Saudi.
Yeah.
And that tells me exactly how you feel about us and how you feel about the region and what we're doing here and how you want to be a part of it. So thanks for allowing us to watch football greatness for a couple decades. And thank you for what you're doing now, you know, post-career. I really, really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And you coming on the show and telling your story.
It's been worth waiting for, man. It's been a great interview. Sir. Appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Good luck with everything and enjoy the next couple of days here.
Thank you.
But do come back again in the winter because that's when I think is...
In our winter.
Yeah,
so like November, December.
Exactly. So okay. December, Jan, Feb would be the best way to experience Alola.
So I can still get a bit of tan?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's definitely. That's important.
You will, for sure.
All right, thanks, man. Rio. Thank you.
Much appreciated, brother.
Top man.